This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shamita Basu. Today, how Trump's January 6th pardons signal a new era for militias. One of Donald Trump's first acts as president was something he's long promised, a sweeping grant of clemency to the more than 1,500 people charged in connection with the January 6th attack on the Capitol.
So this is January 6th, and these are the hostages, approximately 1,500 for a pardon.
Yes.
Full pardon.
The families and supporters of the rioters were overjoyed on Monday night when Trump signed the order, and hundreds of people who had been convicted were released from prison.
We the people are victorious today, and we were able to say together, justice for all J6, justice for all
J6. Welcome home, heroes. Welcome home. Let's go.
I want to say only one word tonight. Freedom!
Among the people who've been freed are Enrique Tarrio, the former leader of the Proud Boys, who'd been given the longest sentence of anyone involved in the attack, 22 years, and Stuart Rhodes, the head of the Oath Keepers, who'd been sentenced to 18 years. Both were found guilty of mobilizing their militia groups to try to overthrow the government. And now that they're out, they're calling for prosecutions for the people who put them behind bars. This moment is more than just a rewriting of history of what happened on January 6th. It could have huge implications for America's militia movement.
Right now, we have people who were, for a long time, really on the fringe of society. The leaders of these militias are now returning from prison. You know, they have a credibility that they could never have dreamed of.
That's Joshua Kaplan, a reporter at ProPublica who's been following this story. He told me that we should all be paying attention to these groups and how much these pardons will embolden them moving forward.
I've been following this closely, but still was not expecting this. I mean, every sign in terms of what Trump has been saying, he seemed to be backtracking away from the most sweeping version of this. Vance, just last week, said that obviously, people who committed violence shouldn't be among the people who were pardoned. And then, essentially, they either pardoned or commuted the sentence of every single person, including people who buried a taser into a police officer's neck on January 6th, people who were convicted of conspiring to overthrow the government in really landmark cases. So I think it'd be difficult to overstate how extraordinary and unprecedented of a move this is.
And now we should say, of course, not everyone who participated in January 6th were members of a militia necessarily. Militias did have a large presence there. What do you think these pardons signal to these militia groups?
It's a show of support. After January 6th, even a lot of these militia leaders thought their movement was on the brink of extinction, potentially, that they would not be able to survive the backlash from this. And one of the core factors that led to a turnaround and kind of a resurgence of these groups was Trump and his allies starting to change their tune about what the riot meant. You know, no longer treating the militias involved, the rioters themselves, as pariahs, instead starting to embrace them as political prisoners, as patriots. And then this is the ultimate culmination of that. I mean, to give a little historical perspective here, the last event similar to January 6th in the history of these movements in America was the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, when a man with militia ties blew up a government building and killed more than 100 people. It's one of the deadliest terrorist attacks in American history. The militia movement did not recover from that for over a decade. The backlash was so intense that the movement went dormant, more or less, until a bunch of things happened in 2008, including the election of Barack Obama, that led to the sort of resurgence. That is what a lot of people, including a lot of people in the militia movement, thought would happen after January 6th. So this reshaping of the narrative, it really matters.
What kinds of reactions have you seen in militia groups themselves?
there's a lot of excitement about it. You're seeing people who feel confident that this is going to be great for their organizations, that there are people that have been keeping their distance still out of fear of potential legal repercussions, and those people are now going to feel kind of invincible in kind of far-right forums. You know, where a lot of the early warning signs of January 6th happened, there's celebration, and along with celebration, conversations about violent revenge on the judges, police officers, investigators who were involved in the prosecutions. Mm. And you know, that doesn't mean that's going to happen, but it's still, I think, telling to see this sort of chatter. It's still early days, but we're, you know, beginning to see organizations that had been a little quieter, such as the Proud Boys, seem to be emboldened. There was a decent-sized group of Proud Boys in D.C. on January 20th, Inauguration Day, prior to the pardons, and they seem to perhaps intentionally be communicating, we're back.
We're back, baby! We're back! The boys are back!
Josh has been closely following the militia movement for ProPublica for a while now. For a journalist, this is a tough beat. These groups are deeply skeptical of the media. But Josh's work stands out because he's gotten pretty good access. And recently, he landed a very revealing source. In late 2022, he received an anonymous email from a person who said they were involved in a militia. The message had been sent to several reporters, but Josh was the only one to respond.
To be honest, I was not expecting much.
Josh kept in touch through encrypted calls with this person named John Williams, or at least that's the name he recently adopted legally. John Williams said that he'd been acting as a mole within the militia movement ever since the January 6th attacks. He said seeing what happened that day motivated him to take action.
There was all this talk about democracy being in a kind of mortal peril. He took that literally, and he wanted to do something about it. And so he took it upon himself, without coordinating with the FBI, without even telling his family, to infiltrate the modern militia movement as basically a freelance undercover operative. And he was hoping to somehow, by exposing these groups, to damage the movement as much as a lone man possibly could.
Josh had his reservations, but John had a pile of evidence he had gathered to back up a lot of his claims.
He sent me this package with a thumb drive containing tens of thousands of secret files from inside the militia movement.
The files contained information about how these groups recruit active duty police officers and U.S. soldiers, and more details on who makes up their ranks, from convicted criminals to doctors to government lawyers. And they showed how militias, driven underground after January 6th, have continued to conduct dangerous vigilante operations.
From rounding up migrants at the Mexico border in armed patrols to trying to crack down on voters casting absentee ballots in the midterms. There was surveillance of local journalists and activists assaulting Black Lives Matter protesters. And there was also in these files this drumbeat of heated debates over whether they should escalate things even further and commit acts of mass political violence.
John told Josh that he first got involved with a militia group in Utah while he was working as a wilderness instructor. They asked him to conduct a training back in 2020. After the insurrection in 2021, John got back in touch with them, he said, in order to become a member. And according to the files that he sent to Josh, it was clear that John had a talent for playing the part.
He was incredibly deceitful, and he was incredibly focused about becoming better at being deceitful. He studied cult leaders to better understand how they manipulated people. He kept a journal with every lie he told so that he wouldn't lose track. And so he maneuvered his way through these groups, rising the ranks, getting access to all sorts of sensitive information that even your everyday militia member wouldn't be able to see. That once he was a senior leader, he had access to extremely sensitive records.
Perhaps the most remarkable part of the story isn't just that John spied on these groups. He actively influenced them to take his advice and promote him up the ranks.
One thing that had become kind of an obsession with it, of his, is these armed patrols and street brawls that militias do at Black Lives Matter protests and have done for a long time. And, you know, he was very worried about the potential for more Kyle Rittenhouse-esque shootings in the streets. And so he started working hard to persuade as many militias and militia members as he could to avoid these events. He was sending them rumors that he'd made up, you know, some plot against militia members that was going to happen at this rally. And he told the leaders that he was going to be undercover at these events. And if any militia members went, it put him in jeopardy. And he successfully persuaded these militia leaders to order their troops to stay home.
John also believed that once he went public with his findings, he'd be able to have an even larger impact on militia groups.
He wants to sow distrust inside the militia movement, to really become sort of a boogeyman, this like cautionary tale passed down from militiaman to militiaman of, you know, by going public now with his story and the details of just how much trust he was able to get before betraying everyone. Mm. You know, he told me that he wants militiamen every time that they're in a meeting to be thinking in the back of their head, this guy will betray me.
Mm.
These groups, in order to grow as large as they do, they have to have a big tent and they have to take a lot of people. And that size is what makes them potent. These aren't some high-powered cells of five elite operatives. But if you have tens of thousands of members and you want to do something dangerous, maybe not all 10,000 are going to go do it, but it's going to be a lot easier to find 50 who will. That's how we get things like January 6th. That's how we get all sorts of plots, some of which have been foiled by the FBI, some of which haven't over the past 20 years. Mm. And that thing that makes militias so enduring and so potent these days also makes them a lot easier to infiltrate.
Mm.
And by kind of making that unignorable for militia leaders, John is hoping that he will cause enough distrust that it will have a material effect of weakening these organizations.
So tell me, how did John eventually disentangle himself from these groups? When did he decide he was out?
So he was on this Zoom call with just a few other militia members. Basically, how to get involved in your local government was the theme of the call. But towards the end of the call, this woman starts talking about a problem in her small town in Virginia. The town's vice mayor was under fire for a homophobic remark. And she believed that this local journalist who was covering the controversy was leading a secret far-left plot against this vice mayor. And she keeps talking. She says, you know, I think I need to settle a score with this guy. I got to, you know, it's deep state, local level. It's got to be stopped. And John was understandably alarmed by this. He tried to talk with her to try to talk her down, figure out what she meant by settling the score, but she didn't want to talk with him. And so he decides to send an anonymous email to this reporter. The next morning, he wakes up and sees that the reporter has published an article about this disturbing email he's gotten, the email from John. And he's published a screenshot of the whole note. John had left a lot of breadcrumbs that would have made it pretty clear that the person who sent that email was him. And he decides to go on the run. He grabs a bag from his closet. He mails me a hard drive with all of his files. And then he drives 4 hours towards the desert so that he can disappear.
Mm. What can you tell us about what he's up to now? Are you in touch with him?
Yes, I'm in touch with him. I don't want to go into too much detail. He's safe. And he has now released not all of his files, but a significant portion of his files online.
So through all of this observing and documenting, and of course, all these documents and audio recordings that ended up in your hands, what are we able to understand about how these groups operate?
I think these groups are a lot stranger than people realize. The fundamental thing they do is paramilitary activity. It's training with guns. You know, that's everything from storming buildings together with guns drawn to, you know, practicing taking sniper shots from half a mile away. And then using guns in various activities in the real world, whether that's, you know, patrolling a left-wing protest or, you know,
obviously in the worst case, plots to commit violence against political figures. But there's also this entirely separate aspect of these groups that's almost more like a Rotary Club. They do community service together. They celebrate Valentine's Day and Easter Sunday as a group. They have gardening classes where they, you know, teach each other how to save money on groceries through, you know, cultivating food. One of these militias he was in had its own monthly magazine with, you know, militia news at the front and patriotic word games for kids at the back. And so, you know, the leaders of these groups are aware that this other side of it is kind of good for marketing. It's good for being able to sell themselves to people in positions of power and, you know, build sort of alliances. But it also has the impact that for a lot of people in these groups, you know, the militia is one of the most fulfilling things in their lives. I mean, I talk to people that, you know, military veterans who find through the militia that tight-knit bond that they had been searching for ever since they got home from serving with their squad overseas. Mm. Militias in the past have not been as resilient as militias today. And I think part of the reason for that is that they have this these kind of two sides to them that enables them to roll with the punches better.
Yeah, it's like meeting this unmet need for a lot of people, a need for community.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, you know, who can understand that?
You know, one thing that was a little bit surprising to me, and maybe might be to others, is just how porous some of these groups are, for lack of a better word. I mean, it sounds like John Williams joined one group, but kind of found himself joining another, and that that's not an uncommon thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. These aren't like gangs, where you're in a gang, and then that's your gang. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very common for people to just cycle between these groups, like, you know, square dance partners. They have a shared ideology and they view themselves as working towards the same nebulous goal.
Yeah. And what, I mean, you call it a nebulous goal. I was just going to ask, what exactly is that goal? Like, what is the training for?
That is the hardest question to answer about these organizations, because they, I think, deliberately keep it very vaguely defined. What they really have is kind of a shared set of grievances. And it's grievances that aren't that outside of the mainstream of politics these days. It's a lot of, you know, worry about gun rights these days, a lot of worry about COVID restrictions, a lot of opposition to Black Lives Matter. And then along with those grievances, there's this firm conviction that they are kind of the final vanguard to protect America from what they see as the tyranny of the federal government and the left. And that can manifest in a whole range of ways. But because there's no agreement on the end goal, and because these groups are so disparate, you know, there's constant debate about how exactly they should put all of this paramilitary training into practice. And I think, you know, when these groups become the most dangerous is when that debate starts to swing in a certain direction, and it starts getting more and more towards, okay, the time has finally come for us to take violent action against our enemies.
Mm. Do you have a better understanding now that you've had access to all this material that John Williams has given you and others, other sources of yours? Do you have a better understanding of how these groups interact with law enforcement? We know that law enforcement, there are some active law enforcement members who are parts of these groups. A lot of them are former. It's a really interesting tension.
It's fascinating. I mean, maybe the scale of it was a little more than I was expecting, but that wasn't shocking to me as someone who's done some reporting on these groups before. What I found most interesting was getting a view into their playbook for building those ties. These groups view having allies in law enforcement as absolutely fundamental to their success, because so much of what they do is put themselves into incredibly volatile situations with guns. And ideally, they want law enforcement to be fighting alongside them, but at least they want law enforcement to leave them alone, to see them as a friend. And so they put an enormous amount of effort in this kind of a business school group project-esque way into deepening their ties with local law enforcement authorities. And they have a range of tactics, from how to pitch yourself to a law enforcement officer, how to use community service as a way of making law enforcement more comfortable with you and make them think that, you know, that you're a positive part of the community. And they talk about this in kind of very cynical terms sometimes. Like, this is a, you know, community service can be a means to that end of building these ties with law enforcement. There's no question inside the militias that they're militias, but when they're talking to law enforcement, they give them brochures that say, in all caps, "We are not a militia," with roughly 5 exclamation points. You know, one of the
That'll do it.
It actually works, though. I mean, it creates confusion. It creates ambiguity. And it got to the point in one of these national militias that the leaders sent spreadsheets to every member with a list of every sheriff in their state and instructions to reach out to these sheriffs and mark which ones were friendly and which ones weren't. So this is a fascinatingly organized effort.
I mean, what is the allure for active law enforcement members to be joining paramilitary groups?
I feel like I got a better understanding of that question by looking at this Oath Keepers leader, Bobby Kinch. And I mean, to give a little background on him, he spent 23 years in the Las Vegas police. He, you know, was a detective who served in elite units. He ultimately was part of this, what he called the Black Squad, which was tasked with investigating violent crimes where the suspect was African American. And he kind of burned out of the department after this scandal where on Facebook, he publicly said he was ready for a race war.
He joined that was in 2013 or so, if I remember.
2013, yeah. And he was out of the department by 2016, when it soon after it became public what happened. And he joined the Oath Keepers because he says he had this feeling like he wasn't done yet. And, you know, all the fascinating details about him from these tapes, I mean, I'm not going to be able to summarize, but you could see this real nostalgia for the thrill of high-octane police work, the thrill of having genuine authority to use guns and your fists when need be to stop problems in your community. And he misses it. One line he said stuck with me. It was, I'm paraphrasing slightly, but when people tell me violence doesn't solve anything, I look back over my police career and I say, wow, that's interesting, because violence sure did solve quite a bit. And so it really left the impression that he is kind of trying to recreate what he felt while he was had a badge, now without any actual government authority or government oversight.
Well, then, moving forward, do you have a sense of what these militia groups will feel called to do? Like, what will they see as their mission now under this new Trump administration?
It's hard to predict, in part because we're moving into unprecedented territory, but also because these groups are very, very responsive to current events and to political discourse. So something that a lot of experts have on their mind right now is immigration. Militias have a long history of doing vigilante operations like armed patrols at the border to try to crack down on immigrants and support immigration enforcement in some way. And that's a long and sometimes quite bloody history of these operations. And, you know, something I've heard a lot is this question of, as Trump begins to execute his immigration policies, you know, are militias going to be emboldened to do that at a larger scale and more aggressively? I think a lot of people are expecting that they might or they will. But I think it's really going to depend on what becomes a flashpoint in the coming months and years. It's an important question because every time we've seen militias with the wind in their sails, militias on the upswing, eventually the result is some act of significant political violence that shocks the nation.
Well, Josh, this was really, really fascinating reporting. Thanks for talking to us about it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Josh Kaplan is a reporter at ProPublica. You can read his story, The Militia and the Mole, on Apple News. We'll put a link to it on our show notes page.